Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another APS Portfolio Strategy Call. Today, it is Outlook 2023, the Out of Consensus Call. I'm Steve Abrahams, Head of Investment Strategy here at APS. Last year on this call, we predicted that volatility would run much higher than the forward volatility markets imagined. And it turns out that even then, we a little bit fell down on the job because volatility, our projection at least, was way too low. This year has been one of the most volatile years in the markets on record, and still, frankly, is difficult to predict. Today, we wanted to focus on areas where our views really break from consensus, at least in a material way. These are the areas where excess investment return is either won or lost, and we hope our views today will help you think through your portfolio position for next year. So, Amir, let's move to the next slide, if you will.
Steve, we're still sharing your screen if you want to go ahead and change slides.
Oh, that's true. Slides. Okay, thank you. So we're going to go have our senior analysts really lead you through highlights of their views in a few sections, starting with the economy with Stephen Stanley. I'll then cover some highlights of markets. Brian Landy will cover agency MBS, Mary Beth Fisher, CMBS, Caroline Chen, CLOs, and then Tom O'Hara will wrap us up with a few highlights of bank strategy. And then hopefully we'll have some time left for Q&A. You'll notice that there is a chat feature in the webinar where you can put questions in, and that's really the way that we're going to take the questions. So feel free to send your questions through that chat feature throughout the presentation, and then at the end of the session, we'll pick those up and we'll relay them to the proper analyst. In any event, we want to start with Stephen Stanley. Stephen unfortunately couldn't be here for the call today, but he prepared some pre-recorded remarks. So let's see what those are.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining. My name is Stephen Stanley, and I'm going to give you my out-of-consensus calls for the economy in 2023. And I thought I would start by kind of setting the stage and giving you what is currently the consensus view. The consensus view has the economy falling into a shallow recession in early 2023. The latest set of economic forecast shows a very modest decline in real GDP in the first half of the year, followed by increase in the second half. So consensus was for a short and short recession, and that's a recession very soon. That means a significant tightening, or excuse me, loosening in the labor market, with the unemployment rate rising to somewhere around 4.5% by late next year. And the consensus also expects the inflation, the rate of inflation, to decline very quickly by the second quarter of next year. The consensus view is that inflation will be running at a rate of less than 3%, more or less 0.2s per month for both total and core. So a very quick deceleration in prices. All right. So with that as a backdrop, let me offer you a few possible out of consensus results for the economy next year. The first one is that I think a recession will be deferred. I don't rule out a recession. In fact, a recession might even be an odds-on bet, but I do not see it happening quite so quickly. I think it's more likely, if we're going to get a recession, it's more likely to be in 2024 or possibly toward the end of next year. And the main reason that I believe the economy will prove more resilient in the short term is that households are still sitting on an immense pool of resources that were accumulated during the pandemic. Households accumulated several trillion dollars in cash and easily spendable money over the course of the pandemic. They have started to tap into that. We've seen savings rates decline, and I think that that cushion has started to be tapped into, but it's going to take a while for households to exhaust that extraordinary cushion that they're sitting on. And as a result, I think consumer spending, which we've seen in the last couple of months, has held up quite well. If anything, it seems like it's accelerated in September and October. I think consumer spending in real terms is going to continue to grow in the first half of next year. So my second out-of-consensus call would be that I think the labor market also holds up better than expected. We saw it yet again last Friday, a stronger than expected payroll number, and indeed the payroll figure has exceeded consensus expectations 9 straight months. Economists continue to basically to call for about a 50,000 deceleration in job growth over the last several months, and every month the payroll number comes in a little better than expected. And I think, you know, what we're seeing is that even though there is a cooling in labor demand, the labor market was so out of balance before, demand was so much in excess of supply, that even though it's cooling and it's coming back toward balance, we're still in a tight labor market situation. Labor demand remains extraordinarily strong. The JOLTS job openings numbers have come off, but they're still several million higher than the all-time high prior to the pandemic. I think we're seeing layoffs in specific industries, but those workers are, you know, there's plenty of jobs available in other industries, and in particular, there's several industries that seem to be still playing catch up, whether it's leisure or healthcare or education, some of the categories of the employment numbers that were the slowest to come back after the pandemic. Now I think firms are starting to really move to try to staff up. The bottom line here is I think that the labor market does remain tight for quite some time. I think the unemployment rate may not have reached its low yet. We've gotten as low as 3.5. We're currently at 3.7. I wouldn't be surprised if we see a return to 3.5 and possibly even a tick or two lower. But more importantly, I think the unemployment rate holds below 4% for most, if not all, of next year. And of course, that has implications for continued strong wage growth, which we did see again last Friday. And in turn, that has implications for inflation, which is my next out-of-consensus call. I believe that inflation will moderate next year, but only gradually. Remember, I said that inflation is going to, that the consensus thinks inflation is going to decelerate very quickly. And I think it will come down, but it will come down gradually in my view. Inflation has become very broad. Lot of category. I mean, basically almost every category at this point. It'd be much easier to talk about the ones that aren't growing at a high rate than to talk about the ones that are at this point. And we will see relief, but it's going to take time. We know, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the shelter cost component, for example, and that should come off because the housing market has eased, but the historical relationship there suggests that it might be spring of next year before that category even peaks out. Kind of similar story with healthcare, where labor costs in that industry have continued to rise in the first half of the year, and that suggests that healthcare inflation is likely to continue picking up in the near term. So I do have inflation coming off, but only to around 4% on a year-over-year basis by late next year. So I think all of 2023 inflation is going to be quite a bit higher than what the Fed would like to see. And that brings me to my final out-of-consensus call, which regards monetary policy. And I believe that the Fed is going to be on hold once it reaches its peak in the first half of 2023. I believe it's going to be on hold for an extended period of time. And, of course, Fed funds futures have for quite some time priced for a quick pivot. You know, once the markets believe that once the Fed gets to its peak rate, that it will stay there for a short period of time, and then within 3 to 6 months it will start to ease. And modest easing has been priced into the late 2023 Fed funds futures contracts now for quite some time. In contrast, I believe that the Fed is going to have to wait much longer until inflation gets to the point where they're comfortable enough to begin lowering rates. I don't expect to see a Fed ease until probably the middle of 2024, if not later. So despite what the Fed funds futures are saying, my take would be that the Fed is on hold. Once it gets to its peak in the first half of next year, it's going to be on hold for quite some time. And that, those are my out of consensus calls. Thank you very much.
Okay. And thank you, Stephen Stanley, for your remarks. Now, let's see. We need to get back and take a look at our slides again, which I suppose I should be able to share. Let's see if I can do that.
Yes. You have the presenter role.
Okay, and I hope I'm sharing those slides right now. Let's see if I can turn this into a, this is the wrong one. I apologize, everybody. New technology. Let's see if we can find our magic slides. Well, I think this is going to have to do right here, I hope. There we go. I guess we're going to operate off of this set for now. So let me talk about a handful of calls plus one that I think breaks with consensus right now. The first is that the U.S. 10-year rate is going to drop below 325. The second, that the twos, tens yield curve slope is going to approach negative 100 basis points. The third is the range for implied volatility drops in half, so a reversal really of our call from last year. The fourth, that home price appreciation from December to December stays positive, maybe barely positive, but positive. The fifth, the levered loan and CLO markets surf a wave of downgrades. And then finally, the last, the Fed does not sell MBS. There's a few, the rates and the housing call I want to focus on today. So the reason for these rates calls really is a combination of fundamentals and then the market likely learning a significant amount from the year ahead. Let's first talk about the 10-year rate. When we originally wrote the Outlook piece just before Thanksgiving, the 10-year note was about at 380. And our view still then and remains now that we're likely to see that 10-year rate drop below 325. That's built really on two major blocks of rationale. The first is that the fair value of long treasury rates, 10 years and out, is really somewhere in the neighborhood of 250 to 3%. It's not hard to get into that range. Certainly the Fed has told us that they expect inflation to be around 2% over the long run. And as Stephen Stanley indicated in his remarks, five-year forward break-evens indicate as much as well. The market believes that too. So if you look at inflation at 2%, then the missing ingredient for fair value is the real rate of return. The Fed has set its long-run neutral Fed funds rate at 2.5, so the Fed implicitly is saying 2 plus 50 basis points of real rate gets you to fair value. And we're giving an extra margin because some analysis recently has suggested it could be slightly higher than that. We've seen higher rates since August, as you can see in the chart on the upper left, and that, in our view, has been largely due to a combination of heavy issuance from the Treasury and selling, the Fed by banks, by asset managers, really driving rates higher. Going forward, we expect, in fact, we are highly confident that Treasury issuance is going to drop by roughly $1 trillion in the fiscal year 2023. That's based on Congressional Budget Office projections. And We believe that significant demand that we saw this year from foreign private portfolios to the tune of about $750 billion is going to grow. Just look at the geopolitical risks. Just look at Europe heading into recession. And those things are going to serve to drag the long end of the curve back down towards fair value. In the process, to the upper right-hand graph, we expect the 2s-10 slope to approach negative 100 basis points. Again, when we wrote this shortly before Thanksgiving, it was below negative 70. It has since climbed to around negative 77. We believe that if you imagine the Fed holding Fed funds above 5% over the course of a year and then potentially easing in a measured way, code for 25 basis points a meeting, repeatedly, that it would be easy for the rates market to price 2 years in the mid fours, 10 years in the, as we've indicated, the mid to low threes, and that's where you get your negative 100 basis point inversion. And as you can see in that upper right chart, plenty of precedent for that in the early 80s, the last time we saw inflation at these levels. Then the final issue around rates is volatility, and we expect that to drop significantly in the year ahead. Right now, fundamental uncertainty, the ability to predict a wide range of economic factors, headline CPI, core CPI, GDP, existing home sales, is at record levels. You can see that in the survey of professional forecasters from the Philly Fed. But the Fed has launched into its experiment with tightening, and by this time next year, we collectively as a market will have learned a significant amount, and as a result, the vol range should drop substantially in the course of the year. I also want to focus on our housing calls, which I think are out of consensus as well. And there we're looking for effectively a flat to slightly positive market December to December. Now, I want to emphasize that if you look back over the broad sweep of home price history, it's a very easy case to make. On the upper left, you can see that we have had positive home price appreciation in 6 of the last 7 recessions, the only exception being the global financial crisis, which I think is what many people are assuming is the norm. It really is the exception. We also have seen positive HPA in 6 of the last 7 Fed tightening cycles. Again, many people believe that the great global financial crisis was the norm. In fact, in the when it comes to home price history, it's the exception. In the lower left, you can see a chart of affordability. This is the National Association of Realtors, and many people have acknowledged, and it's clearly the case, that affordability has dropped. But low affordability or high affordability historically does not necessarily predict home prices very easily. We saw extremely low affordability in the early 80s when the 30-year mortgage rate was 18%. But as I indicated in the chart above, home prices rose. And then again, immediately after the global financial crisis, we saw extremely high affordability as interest rates were low, but prices nevertheless fell. So the reason for this is that homes trade in a price targeting market, not a price clearing market. And that's because homeowners can stay in their property. They can withdraw their offer, and if they need to, they can rent their property as well, something that's increasingly easy. But homeowners must be able and willing to stay in their property, and the case study of that is California from 1975 to 1985, and then just north of the U.S. border, Vancouver as well. We saw high Fed funds rates. We saw recession. We saw high mortgage rates. Home prices went up in California, but they fell in Vancouver substantially. And the difference was homes in California were funded with fixed rate debt, homes in Vancouver with floating rate or ARMs. And those homeowners with ARMs were not able to afford the high rates that they ended up getting on their mortgages. So the relevant history for thinking about next year is not the global financial crisis. It's really the early 80s when home prices continued to go up, and we're looking for a flat to rising market for home prices next year. I now want to pass this on to my colleague Brian Landy, who will talk about what we should expect in agency MBS. Brian, take it away.
Thank you, Steve. Good afternoon, Steve. Everyone, and thanks for joining us. So I think a top issue next year for agency MBS is going to be heavy supply that requires wide spreads to attract demand. Agency MBS net supply is likely to remain high as a result of home price appreciation over the last few years and Fed MBS portfolio runoff. And that should keep the pressure on spreads and OASs to stay historically wide, and dollar rolls less likely to run special. So we just start with the net supply, which soared during the pandemic. And net supply is closely linked to home sales. Higher new home sales contributes directly to supply, and existing home sales also contributes, since new loans are typically larger than the loan that was paid off. And so it isn't just the volume of home sales that matters. It's the value of those homes and the size of the associated loans. The record run-up in home prices played a big role in creating the big supply during the pandemic by making the purchase loans larger. And, the size gap between existing loans and their replacements, so for thinking of existing home sales, has almost doubled since 2019. Now, over the course of this year, while home sales and supply have fallen, and home sales have fallen below pre-pandemic levels, net supply has remained higher than before the pandemic. And that's because of the loan size effect. Supply isn't likely to permanently shift to pre-pandemic levels without a large drop in home prices, which, like Steve just talked, we don't think is likely to happen, or another big drop in home sales. And now, the first slide, that's on page 10, shows the net supply projections linked to home sales forecasts done by the MBA, that's the green line, and Fannie Mae, that's the purple line. And kind of the midpoint is to expect net supply to average around $30 billion a month. So, again, that's an average, and monthly numbers should fall through the winter and rebound in the spring. So there's definitely going to be some movement in that. But that $30 billion a month is about 50% higher than the average level over the few years prior to 2020. And I really think that has a lot to do with home price growth. And so the chart also includes just a couple scenarios as we kind of show more extreme assumptions. The light blue line at the top just shows what net supply might look like, assuming home sales were to continue at the 2021 pace. And the red line shows sales at a half of the 2021 pace. So it's kind of an extreme high and low. Now, on top of the new supply from originations, Fed runoff should contribute another $20 billion a month. And so that would bring about the total to about $600 billion for the year that other MBS investors would need to buy. And so who is going to buy those? The next slide shows who owned MBS over the last few years. The second to last column shows the change from the end of 2019, so right before the pandemic, to the middle of this year. And really effectively, the only investors that added large amounts of MBS were banks and the Fed, adding about $1.2 and $1.3 trillion respectively. And at the very bottom of that column, it shows the net supply. So the actual increase in outstanding agency MBS over that period was about $1.7 trillion. And really, so together, banks and Fed bought all of that net supply and, approaching $1 trillion from other investors. The last column then shows a change from the end of 2021 to the middle of this year. And probably the biggest change is, banks have allowed their holdings to shrink $163 billion, but they still own a historically large share of the outstanding MBS at about 40%, where the historical average is much closer to 30%. And the Fed, over the first half of the year was still net adding MBS. Runoff didn't start until June, so this doesn't really show that yet. But that really means that other investors did not add a lot of mortgage-backed securities over the first half of the year. Now, the Fed has had a big presence in the market for many years. And before that, really, the GSEs were big players. But neither is adding MBS now. And banks don't appear ready to add MBS again. So any downsizing to their portfolios would introduce even more supply for other investors to handle. Now, banks shrink MBS holdings at the same pace next year as they did in the first half of this year. That would push the total supply of MBS that needs to be absorbed by other investors to over $900 billion, which just about matches the amount of selling those investors did during the 2 years of COVID. And so I think, again, the problem is none of the other investors are as big as banks and the Fed. You know, money managers and foreign investors, you know, would presumably have the deepest pockets. But they and others, you know, can weigh mortgages against other assets. And, you know, on an absolute dollar basis, foreign investors already own more MBS than they did before the pandemic. So I think spreads will just need to stay wide enough to entice the money managers, foreign investors, REITs, insurance companies, and home loan banks. I think you really kind of need everybody to get involved to add a sufficient MBS. Although there's more likely to be, and I think it is true, there's likely to be more volatility than before, you know, because these investors are more, you know, spread sensitive. So it's a very different environment than one, you know, where the Fed and banks are buying heavily month after month. So now shifting gears, I just want to talk some about housing turnover, which I think probably plays some out of consensus. I think it's not going to fall as much as many people fear. I mean, I agree, you know, certainly there is lock-in, and I think that's a big reason that home sales is cooled this year, and I think turnover right along with it. But aggregate turnover, you know, over the last 20 years, has generally never fallen below 6 to 7 CPR. So I think it's much more likely to return to those levels. You know, over the next year, maybe at the low end of the range and then recovering towards the higher end, you know, say in 2024. You know, the exception to that, you know, was turnover during the distress years following the pandemic. Many borrowers were underwater on their loans. And then, you know, turnover speeds dropped, you know, down into the, say, low 5 CPR range. And, you know, I think a lack of equity puts a big damper on turnover. But today's borrowers have big equity cushions, and that should help prevent a repeat of the post-2008 experience, you know, despite the higher mortgage rates. And I think this equity growth is a key for many borrowers to buy a new home. You know, they have leverage in their home, and that magnifies the, you know, the equity growth is magnified when home values increase. And that becomes a source of the down payment for a bigger home. And a lot of people will face unavoidable reasons to move. And there's marriage and divorce, having kids, kids moving out, getting better job opportunities, and so on. And, you know, that equity helps unlock that and allows it to happen. And, you know, could happen despite, you know, higher financing costs. I think, you know, some people will be reluctant to allow, you know, that financing just to be, you know, the sole determinant of, you know, kind of where they live. And others, you know, might expect that, you know, in the future they'll be able to refinance. And so not think of that loan as, you know, being something there. The higher rate loan is being locked in for, you know, the full 30 years. You know, I think the bigger risk of turnover to me would come from a weakening economy and a big drop in home prices that would eat away at that equity. You know, but our view is that, you know, we're not going to see a recession next year. And there is, you know, and with the shortage of housing and, you know, kind of all the factors that Steve mentioned, you know, I think it's more likely that prices flatten out or are slightly positive for a while before rebounding maybe to the you know, typical 3 to 5% annual growth rate. I think an economy not in recession and, you know, then with that flat to slightly positive home price appreciation is just likely to bring us back to normal, but not distressed turnover levels. You know, besides that, you know, in the piece, you know, I talked about some things, you know, some views on cash out refi volume, which, you know, still running at about 15% of total production, despite, you know, the big backup in rates, you know, FHA loan assumptions, which I think, you know, that is something to maybe worry about in newer Ginnie Mae production where home prices are more likely to be close to flat or only slightly positive. And that could, you know, allow some borrowers to work through assumptions. So thoughts on higher loan limits and then FHA insurance premiums, which I think next year, you know, I think the signals are that, you know, this is finally the time that there should be a drop. But, you know, as long as rates are high, I think, you know, the market impact should be fairly muted. So I hope everybody checks all that stuff out, and I'll hand the call back to Steve. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Brian. So we want to move on at this point and talk a little bit about what's going on in the commercial real estate space. And Mary Beth Fisher, who is our senior analyst on that market, will guide us through a few out-of-consensus views. Mary Beth.
Hi, good morning. Good afternoon, Steve.
Good afternoon, Steve.
Hi to everyone. Thanks for joining us. I would love to be as constructive on the commercial real estate market as Brian and Steve are on the residential real estate market, but unfortunately that's not going to quite be the case. But I agree definitely with Steve Stanley that a strong economy is going to keep the commercial real estate market, it's going to keep a floor under it. So what we're seeing right now, we've already started to see, is that prices have started to turn over, to decline a little bit. And that's because of the very rapid rise in interest rates. So as we see that, we see the Fed continue to increase interest rates and kind of hold them high for most of next year, commercial real estate prices are going to adjust and they're going to fall. And our projection is they'll fall by anywhere from 10% to 15% with a little bit of discrimination across asset categories, property sectors. And that's really good. And they're going to fall based almost entirely on the rise in interest rates. And cap rates, when property prices fall, cap rates will adjust by rising by 1% to 1.5%. You've already started to see some of this happening. If you look at the multifamily sector in particular, cap rates were actually below 5% for a while. They're now already at 5.5%. We think they will get to 6 or even 6.5% by the middle of next year. The good thing about that trend next year is despite the fall in property prices, there won't be a large deterioration in fundamentals. And that's where I kind of veer away from some of the very bleaker outlooks that there's going to be a large rise in delinquencies. There's going to be a tremendous amount of, you know, not tremendous, I don't think anyone's, except for office, we'll talk about that at the very end. But, you know, you're going to see buildings, unlike residential housing, when the loan matures, these buildings do have to go out and find new financing, and that financing is going to be more expensive. And for investors, if you read the Wall Street Journal today, there was actually two great articles that came out that were talking about how investors at BlackRock and Blackstone and Starwood have pulled some money out of these big private REITs because they want to be out of the commercial real estate space. There's still a lot of money coming into real estate, so right now it's a little bit of a churn, but that's going to, if you're an investor and you can get 5% in treasury bills, why are you going to invest in a property that has a 5% cap rate? That's a very difficult thing, benefit, you know, cost-benefit analysis to make, and you would definitely say, I want to see higher cap rates before I'm willing to go back into that investment. So that's sort of what we expect to occur through next year. As long as the economy, again, you have low unemployment rate, you have reasonably strong consumer spending, none of that is terrible for commercial real estate in the fundamentals. Multifamily rents have already started to come down. They'll continue to come down. They will probably, they've turned negative on a month-over-month basis. They will probably be zero to possibly slightly negative on a year-over-year basis by late next year, but it's going to be, if that happens, it's probably going to be brief, and then they're going to go right back to their trajectory of being, you know, kind of usually a 2 to 3% increase in rents over the time. And, again, that's good for everyone. It's good for wage earners. It's good for all the millennials that had to move in with their parents. great Bloomberg article on that today. So what do CMBS investors need to look at, and what does that do to the spreads? CMBS and CRE CLOs are a little bit in from the wides, which they hit around the middle of November, early to mid-November. But there hasn't been any new issuance, so all of the tightening that's occurred has really occurred entirely in the secondary market. Now, the good news for, if you can think about it as good news, which I do, a property price depreciation is it's going to keep transaction volume has been very low in the third quarter. It's even lower in the fourth. It's not going to pick up in the first quarter of next year. It's possibly going to start picking up in the second and third quarter of next year, but all of that means new issue volume in CMBS and CRE CLOs is also going to be low. That lack of supply is going to keep a little bit of a lid on spreads. So if we're not at the very top of spreads, if we weren't at the very top of spreads recently, we're probably really close to it or within epsilon of the top. So right now, we continue to think that if you want to be in the short end of the curve, stay in floaters in CRE CLOs and SASB floaters. That's a great place to be. But really, you know, to pick up Steve's point, if you think the curve is going to stay very inverted and long rates are going to continue to go down by the end of next year, you're going to want to start stepping out in duration very soon. And especially you can do two things. You can, this credit curve itself, like if you look at from AAA rated to BBB rated, and if you don't get this, please reach out to us. I can send you our relative value report, but has gotten tremendously steeper over the last 3 months through this entire move wider. And that's where we're going to see the best compression is if you look at AA through BBB, CMBS, CRE CLOs in that part of the stack, they have a tremendous amount of room to, as things turn out not to be that bad next year, you'll see that start to compress a lot. You're looking at CRE CLOs are really the best because they're the widest. They have some extension risk, so talk to our desk about that. If you're looking at conduit CMBS, we have a strong interest in cleaner deals. Our traders can walk you through all of which deals they like, which they don't. They do a phenomenal job re-underwriting those deals because, obviously, office makes up about 30% of the collateral outstanding in conduit CMBS, and you just want to make sure you're avoiding – you have enough credit enhancement and you're avoiding those places where you could get higher losses, and then you'd want to stay in, like, the A to A minus to triple B plus tranches of those deals. But if you stay in those, you can get – 9.5% to 10.5% yields right now. That's a tremendous pickup. And again, when things turn out not to be as bad, you'll get a lot of tightening and you can get the greatest payoff in that area. Another trade that we like next year, in the prepay story, you're going to continue to see higher than expected prepays, and that's going to be from 4 CPR to maybe 9 CPR in Ginnie Mae project loans in vintages from 2016 to 2019. Because these are the vintages where they've gotten a tremendous amount of market property price appreciation. They can still sell those properties, potentially get out, and they can still pay the penalties and prepay the loans. We've seen that before. We've already seen it. We had like 9 CPR last month. We've had about almost 5 CPR this month. December is going to be very, very slow, but then you'll probably start to see it kind of level out in the high single-digit CPR next year. So that's a really great place to be to pick up some additional prepay, whether you do it because you like IOs, Ginnie Mae Project Loan IOs, or you do it because you like the deep discount Ginnie Mae Project Loan principal and interest bonds. Again, please get in touch with us. Love to talk to you more about this and have our traders talk to you about which deals they like. One note I'm going to make, which is a little bit boring because it's on everybody's radar, is office, again, on its absolute own trajectory. There's kind of a story came out today that there are people who think that it could have as much of a 40% downdraft. Again, that's going to be urban core offices, not office generally. But that's offices in New York, in Los Angeles, in San Francisco. And those are New York, obviously, makes up a tremendous amount of that collateral. So that's what you want to look out for. Please stay in touch with us. Stay in touch with the desk. And I will turn it back to Steve.
Okay. Thanks, Mary Beth. So we want to move now to another area of the market, and that's CLOs. I indicated in some of the material earlier in this hour that we expected a wave of downgrades in levered loans and CLOs. Caroline Chen has been watching that very closely, and let's turn it over to her for the details. Caroline, take it away. Caroline, are you there? Well,
Caroline, you have to unmute yourself.
You have to unmute yourself.
Is she having any luck there? Okay, unfortunately, I think we've lost Caroline on this one.
No, I'm back, Steve.
Oh, okay, Caroline, you want to go ahead and take us through your CLO view?
Thank you.
Sorry for the technical issues.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining our 2023 CLO Outlook Call. The first supply we expect in the CLO market next year is a wave of loan downgrades. Consensus is managers can trade their way through the stress next year. But CLOs look vulnerable to a wave of loan downgrades, especially the B-minus loans. And it looks like a few CLOs may be able to escape. The reason for that is B-minus loan in average CLO portfolio today is close to 30%. Many leveraged loan borrowers have faced rising borrowing costs in a slowing outlook this year. And the trend is hardly to reverse next year. Just one notch drop, those B-minus loans will turn into triple C and push up a CLO exposure to triple C credits. Now, combined with loan purchased at a discount price, the defaults in the loan portfolio, many CLO portfolio tests, like over-collateralization tests, may be at a risk. A trigger breach will divert the cash flow away from equity and junior debt, and the spreads on the junior debt usually widen following the trigger breach event. And in the same deal, the senior debt may follow that trend as well. Rating performance in recent pandemic period provide a good example for investors. Shortly after start of the pandemic, the triple C credits in broadly syndicated loan CLO tripled to 12% from February to May. And the junior OC test cushion also dropped significantly to a very low level in June. As a result, S&P downgraded 471 broadly syndicated loan CLO tranches, and most downgrades came from double B-rated credit or below. The average CLO portfolio triple C credits concentration is around 4% to 5% today. So if B-minus downgrades rise too close to 12%, most CLOs will be on the brink of breach that max allow the triple C credit exposure. And that 12% margin seems a very low hurdle because downgrades in past recessionary periods far exceeded that level. Based on S&P study on 1 year, a pool of static B-minus issuer, 1 year rating transition analysis, the average between 2001 and 2021 was 18%. Taking other time periods, for example, in 2009, during the Great Financial Crisis, that was 44%. In 2020 pandemic period, that was 34%. If a similar B-minus rating transition rate in pandemic will happen next year, most CLOs will have average triple C exposure close to 15%. That's even higher than the level we saw in pandemic. Now, exceeding the max allowed triple C credit exposure does not necessarily mean the deal will fail the over-collateralization test right away. Investor needs to factor in loans purchased at a discount dollar price and the defaults in the portfolio. But it does add the credit-related risk and make the spreads of those deals may stay on the wide end of the range. There are ways to limit your exposure to those supplies. And we think perhaps the simplest way is just to stay with managers who have a conservative portfolio, like the APS, like low beta manager suggested by APS CLO manager model. Another way to position is to look for deals allow higher triple C, percentage category, especially with deals from managers specialized in distressed credit managing, with expertise, in distressed credit. In other words, high-flex CLOs. Our second surprise from the market next year is the increasing issuance of static CLO. Market consensus is primary market issuance going to go down next year. That may be true for the traditional 5-year reinvestment period, 2-year non-call structured deals. But we think the share of static CLO may continue to rise next year. The reason for that is the challenging condition in primary market we have today may stay, with us in 2023. Issues like higher liability cost, aged warehouse overhead, they're just not going to disappear right away. And some managers, they may find a solution in issuing static CLO. As of October, we have 10 managers tapped the primary market by issuing static CLO. This is also the highest number we've been seeing, from recent years. So static CLO, they may offer some good relative values to investors. Although managers have little influence on a static pool of loans, the structure itself, they do offer transparency on portfolio risk over the time of the deal. And bonds in static CLO, the credit enhancement will build as long as, once the deal closes and start to amortize. We think the pricing tiering in the AAA static CLO may continue. And for relative value investors, they're looking for short duration, high quality paper, and they may find this opportunity very attractive. There's some other bumps on the road as well. For example, the LIBOR SOFA transition without the credit spread adjustment. I will refer you to our publications, Outlook publications, we issued prior to Thanksgiving holidays for the details. That's my high level of the 2023 CLO, market outlook. Feel free to reach out if you have any questions. Again, thank you for joining us today. With that, I'm giving back to Steve.
All right. Thanks very much, Caroline. And then to wrap us up for today, hopefully before the hour's done, is Tom O'Hara, who will give us the highlights in what we expect to see on bank balance sheets. Tom, take us away.
Thank you, Steve. Good afternoon, everyone. I know we're running a little late, so I'll try to be brief. But, as Stephen Stanley said at the top of the call, the market is expecting a recession sooner than later next year. And so with a recession would come a reversal of many of the trends that we saw with banks in 2022. That's generally what the market is expecting, is a reversal. And number one would be loan growth, which has been phenomenal in 2022. So the market is likely expecting that to drop off significantly. Our contrarian view is that that loan growth actually continues well into 2023. You can see the loan growth over the last 12 months in the upper left corner of this page 17. It's been super strong throughout the year, and a lot of that has been coming from C&I loans, so commercial and industrial loans. These are basically unsecured business loans, which really fell off after the PPP program in the second quarter of 2020. That market was really dormant for the second half of 2020 and basically all of 21. That really took off this year and has exploded, as you can see. The C&I market accounted for about 30% of loan growth in 2022. And so short of a recession, we would expect that to continue. Also, while we're not expecting a recession, as Stephen Stanley mentioned, we do see inflation being persistent and starting to bite into the consumer. So the chart on the lower left corner is showing credit cards. Consumer loans basically accounted for about 17% of loan growth in 22, and credit cards were the largest proportion of that, about 70% overall. So as that consumer liquidity starts to fade away, we would expect to see those balances continue to grow, and we have seen in recent months almost record levels of credit card utilization. Resi mortgage is expected to be a weak spot, of course. Refi volumes are down to 22-year lows, so not much activity there. But in terms of purchase volume, there's still a little bit of a pulse in the market. But resi overall was only about 15% of the market in 22. So we certainly think that some of these other loan categories accounting for 85% could step up and really cover any shortfalls from the resi loan market. On the next slide, along with loan growth, we've seen securities portfolio shrink in 2022. So the reverse of that would be securities portfolio stabilizing and even increasing as loan growth falls off. But again, we're expecting the opposite of that to occur. So unfortunately for our sales folks at Amherst Pierpont, we do expect securities portfolios to continue to level off. A lot of them have been static on a dollar basis, but as the balance sheets have grown, they've declined on a percentage basis, and we would expect that to continue, if not on an outright absolute basis. One area of strength in the securities portfolio market is the market for 0% risk weight, and this is primarily Ginnie Mae securities, where banks are able to get a higher yield than they are with just outright treasury securities. And we have seen that proportion of the portfolios grow. They went up another one percentage point in Q3. And so banks are looking to repair their capital ratios as their balance sheets have rotated into these higher risk weight loans and out of lower risk weight securities. We'd expect that trend to continue. On the next page, looking at deposits, deposits have run off in 22 as rates have gone higher. Deposit betas have gone higher as banks have struggled to keep those depositors in-house. If things were going into a recession, we would expect that to stabilize. Instead, we do expect the deposits to continue to run off. What is interesting is that the chart in the upper right corner of this page is showing that a lot of that deposit runoff was really met by banks just letting their cash positions run off as well. And to a lesser extent, that deposit runoff was supplemented with wholesale funding. But that is obviously a trend that cannot continue if banks are going to maintain their liquidity. So we would expect that wholesale funding would have to step in and make up a larger proportion of that deposit runoff going forward into 23. And then the last point that I wanted to make on page 20 is just around asset sensitivity. We did see banks taking some marginal steps in 22 to reduce their asset sensitivity. This is basically asset coupons resetting more quickly than liability coupons. That's a great thing when rates are rising, as they have been in 22, but when rates fall, that can be very detrimental to a bank's earnings. And so banks were taking some small steps this year to put on trades to basically extend duration and reduce that asset sensitivity to help them from an earnings perspective when rates fall. But given that we're not expecting a recession next year, we think in 23 those steps will continue to be fairly incremental and not very widespread in terms of banks really putting on long duration positions to protect against the declining rate environment. We might start to see more and more of that as the year goes on, but in general, we think it will be quite modest. So I know we wanted to leave some time for Q&A, so with that, I'll turn it back over to Steve.
Okay, thanks so much, Tom. Let me see if I can get out of my shared screen and see if I can find where we may have some questions coming from participants. Let's see. Let me check the box here. Okay. So I am seeing one question, and let's go ahead and refer this question to Brian Landy. Brian, you mentioned earlier your thought that we may end up seeing a drop in some of the insurance premiums that FHA charges. Could you elaborate on why and whether you have any thoughts on timing?
Sure. Yeah, I think, the latest annual report showed yet another increase in just the overall health of the insurance fund. I think that, maybe some key things that were mentioned there were that the FHA no longer sees a need to build capital. And that in their strongest stress scenario, which really is a replay of what happened in 2008, it still left the fund at like say positive like 6-ish% capitalization. So I think that in my mind, those are kind of the two signals that I think that some sort of cut in insurance premiums is, you know, really, you know, on the table for next year. I mean, I think it could be a while. It sounds like there's a lot of, you know, maybe administrative hurdles in order to get that done. So it may not be necessarily, you know, going to happen, you know, sooner rather than later. But I think it's definitely, you know, kind of that point where there's a comfort level probably of doing it. Now, I think I just mentioned, I mean, I think a lot of people think back to the 2015 experience when there was a 50 basis point MIP cut and also rates rallied at the same time, right? And so speeds became, you know, extraordinarily fast. I think this environment is very different. You know, most mortgages are, you know, well out of the money. So I think the effect of a MIP cut is going to be very, very muted. And I think the amount of a cut, I mean, I can't see going even 30 basis points, which would put MIPs back to the level that they were prior to the financial crisis, which, you know, ultimately proved insufficient to weather that storm. So I think that in my mind, something much more modest, you know, call it 15 basis points, is much more likely. So, and I think that it won't have nearly the market impact that the cut had in 2015.
Okay. I'm getting a question on commercial real estate. So Mary Beth, this is for you. You mentioned some of these estimates that office property valuations are going to go down. What's some of the thinking behind that? There's obviously issues with occupancy, but how are you or some of your peers arriving at these substantially lower valuations?
A great question. Because really the estimates are all over the map and the data that we've had that's come in so far. Green Street just updated their data and they had kind of their core property price index declined 6% month over month in November. It's down 13% for the year, but office was completely flat on the month. So how could that possibly be? And in fact, office shows barely any declines so far from the peak. You have to know that Green Street tracks those A-plus properties that are in REITs that are in their coverage universe. So it's A-plus properties in New York and on the West Coast and Chicago and Boston. And these are this is the one single part of the office sector that's really maintained its value. So look over at CoStar data, and they've shown office, and they're actually going to update theirs probably any day now if they haven't already. CoStar data covers the entire universe. The entire country of office. It's a much broader look at the national market and it does outside of urban areas and everything else. And it's looking at declines. And I'm going to have to make up a number for them, but I believe that they also have their baseline forecast, I believe, is a 15% decline. I know S&P has stressed theirs to up to a 40% decline in some scenarios. When they've tried to look at what's going to be the effect on ratings. And what you see is a very dramatic change between non-urban areas, not rural, but not New York City office, which they expect to maintain its value fairly well because if people are working from home or doing more home hybrid work or remote work, what they're trying to do is cut down on their commutes, obviously. So the offices that are having the biggest downdraft in lease renewals and higher vacancy rates. New York is already at a peak in vacancy rates, and they're starting to get lease renewals that are 13% lower than they were prior to the pandemic. So both of those trends are going to put more pressure on New York office.
All right.
Outside of the major cities.
No, sorry about that. I didn't mean to cut you off. Did you want to wrap up? We have a few seconds left.
There's actually also some great research from the National Bureau of Economic Research that also expects about a 30% decline because they think the remote to hybrid transition is going to be permanent.
Okay, awesome. We're going to have to leave it there. I have questions on whether banks are going to buy mortgages or any securities next year, and I think I have a question on Caroline, what you referred to, but those are going to have to wait. In any event, thank you very much for listening today. Let me just put in a shameless plug for calls that we have tomorrow with highlights on investment-grade credit, if you've got interested in that, and then on Thursday in emerging markets. But that covers it for us today. Again, thanks for dialing in, and we look forward, of course, to talking to you throughout 2023 to see which of these out-of-consensus calls come true. So thanks, and have a great day.